The same is true at Dorvala, in the Videnda sector. The so-called free trade zones have become battlegrounds between defenseless worlds and corporate giants like the Trade Federation, or criminal cartels like Black Sun, which are squeezing these outlying systems dry.
In an act of what some deemed fair play, and others political guile, the Vice-Chancellor took that moment to allow the Trade Federation's platform to leave its docking station and hover into the dark chill of the rotunda.
"With the Baton's customary impeccable timing,"
Pestage remarked to Doriana. The Trade Federation senator was an unctuous Nymordian named Lot Dodd, whose susurrant snake-charmer's voice wafted through the hall's enunciators.
"I must protest the Supreme Chancellor's accusations."
His words didn't convey anger so much as the arrogance of wealth, a strategy he had learned from his predecessor, Newt Gunray.
"Should the Trade Federation be expected to absorb the losses it has sustained because of pirate attacks? The Republic refuses to create a military to police those sectors, while at the same time prohibiting us from protecting our cargoes with defensive weapons or droid soldiers."
"Now is not the time for this argument, Senator,"
Valorum said, showing the palms of his soft hands. But 100 voices overruled him.
"If not now, then when, Supreme Chancellor?"
The question came from the wheedling, cranial-horned humanoid magistrate of the Corporate Alliance, Passel Argente.
"How many cargoes will the Trade Federation or the Commerce Guild have to lose before we arrive at the proper moment to air this debate? If the Republic cannot protect us, then we have no recourse but to protect ourselves."
Again, Valorum's face flushed.
"In every crisis, we have dispatched paramilitary forces with impressive results."
The interruption came from Lavinia Dorada Vashne Wren, the human female representative of the newly admitted Coloran system.
"The Therian military made quick work of the pirates who were raiding our transports."
Raucous laughter drowned out the rest of her words.
"The only thing Colonel Tramzig did at Kulavan was make himself more contemptible."
Twi'lek Senator Ornfree Tarr bellowed from his platform.
"The good senator from Kulavan was merely deceived by his dubious charms."
Argente spoke once more.
"Does the Supreme Chancellor advocate that each system have a paramilitary force at its command? If so, then why not a pan-galactic military?"
Palpatine's eyes sparkled in sadistic delight. Valorum was getting everything he deserved. He had demonstrated some diplomatic skill during the Stark Hyperspace War, but his election to the Chancellorship had more to do with a pedigree that included 3 Supreme Chancellors and deals he had cut with influential families like the Kalpanas and the Tarkins of Eriadu. His adulation of the Jedi Order was well known, less so his hypocrisy. Much of his family wealth derived from lucrative contracts his ancestors had entered into with the Trade Federation. His election 7 years earlier had been one of the signs Plagueis had been waiting for, the return to power of a Valorum, and had followed on the heels of a remarkable breakthrough Plagueis Insidious had engineered in manipulating midichlorians, a breakthrough the Mune had described as galactonic. Both of them suspected that the Jedi had sensed it as well, light years distant on Coruscant.
"There will be no Republic military,"
Valorum was saying, having taken Argente's bait.
"The Rusan reformations must be upheld. A military force has to be financed. Taxes imposed on the outlying systems would only add to their burden and lead to talk of secession."
"Then let the core worlds pay,"
someone seated below Palpatine shouted.
"The core has no need of military force,"
the Kowati senator responded.
"We know how to live in peace with one another. Why are the Jedi unable to serve as a military?"
the senator from Ord Mantell asked. Valorum turned to look at him.
The Jedi are not an army, and they number too few in any case. They interceded our request, but also at their own discretion. Furthermore, the Order has seen more deaths in the past 12 years than it saw in the previous 50. Yinshaw is fast shaping up to be another Galadron.
Palpatine took secret pleasure in Valorum's reference, since what had occurred at Galadron had been clear evidence of the dark side acting in concert with his and Plagueis' subterfuges. Most important, for Plagueis, the provincial conflict had had a devastating effect on Jedi Master Dooku, deepening his schism with the High Council regarding its decision to deploy the Jedi as warriors.
"Once again, we come full circle,"
Ornfrita's voice boomed through the rotunda.
"The Republic can find the credits to contract with private militaries, but not to raise a military of its own. And yet the Supreme Chancellor sees fit to lecture us on antiquated thinking. Why not simply turn those credits over to the outlying systems and let them do their own contracting?"
"Perhaps the Senator from Ryloth has touched on something,"
Valorum said when the applause died down.
"Better still, perhaps the time has come to impose a tax on the free trade zones to supply the outlying systems with the funds they require."
Palpatine reclined in the platform's padded seat as angry rebuttals spewed from the stations of the Rim Faction worlds, as well as from those belonging to the Trade Federation, the Commerce Guild, the Techno Union, and the Corporate Alliance. How wonderfully and predictably the Senate had deteriorated over the course of 20 years. As had so many ordinary and extraordinary sessions, this one would end in chaos with nothing resolved. For the screens that filled the rotunda, hovercams captured Valorum's sad expression of impotence. Soon, very soon, it would fall to Palpatine to impose order on everyone. Outside the curved walls of the Senate, the crises in the outlying systems had little effect on the lives of the billions who resided on Coruscant. Beings living in the lower levels continued to do their best to survive, while those living closer to the sky continued to spend lavishly on food, fine cloaks, and tickets to the opera, which Valorum had returned to fashion. Palpatine was an exception to the rule. In what sometimes seemed to him like perpetual motion, he met frequently with his peers in the Senate, listening carefully to what each had to say about galactic events, but not so carefully that any had reason to suspect him of being anything other than a career politician, fixed on enhancing his profile. If there was anything that set him apart, it was an impression he gave of taking his job perhaps too seriously. With just over a year remaining in Valorum's second term of office, the chancellorship was up for grabs, and those who knew Palpatine best suspected that he might actually pursue the position if asked. His equivocations on the matter only made him more desirable to those who thought he could bring something new to the mix, an authentic, centrist viewpoint. Others questioned why, given the unprecedented challenges of the times, he or anyone else would aspire to the position. Several days after the Senate met in special session, Palpatine violated the privacy he so valued to host an informal gathering in his suite in 500 Republica. The move to Coruscant's most exclusive address had coincided with Ars Varuna's ascent to the Naboo monarchy 12 years earlier. Varuna's victory had hinged on a renegotiated contract with the Trade Federation for Naboo's plasma. Although it was widely believed that the king and his cronies had fared better from the deal than the citizens of Naboo. Unlike the apartment Palpatine had occupied when he first arrived on the capital world, this one had a dozen rooms, and views of the government district surpassed only by those from the building's spacious penthouses. The Neuranium and Bronzium statue of Sistros, which still concealed the lightsaber he had constructed early in his apprenticeship, shared space with antiquities that had been procured from remote worlds. Fashionably late, Finis Valorum was one of the last guests to arrive. Palpatine welcomed him at the door, while a contingent of cloaked and helmeted Republic guards took up positions in the corridor. The Supreme Chancellor's round face looked drawn, and perspiration beaded his clean-shaven upper lip. Clinging to his arm, like an adornment, was Sei Taria, ostensibly his administrative aide, but also his lover. Just inside the threshold, Volorum hooked his thumbs in the wide blue cummerbund that cinched his robe, and stopped to take in the suite and nod in appreciation.
What the Hollownet newshounds would give to see this. It's hardly a penthouse, Palpatine said dismissively.
Not yet, he means, Corellia Senator remarked, causing several others to lift their drink goblets in a kind of toast. Palpatine pretended to mask embarrassment. Once he would have been acting. Now he wore the guise of Naboo's senator as effortlessly as he wore his robes and cloak.
"Journalists are more than welcome to visit," he said.
Valorum cocked a silver eyebrow in doubt.
"Now that you've gotten them accustomed to transparency and accessibility," Palpatine added.
Valorum laughed without mirth. "For all the good it has done me." Sei Taria broke an awkward silence.
"You certainly make no secret of your favorite color, Senator."
The lids of her oblique eyes were colored to match the burgundy of her sept-silk robe. Her dark hair was twisted into an elaborate bun behind her head, while in front, bangs bisected her flawless forehead.
"Scarlet figures prominently in the crest of my ancestral house," Palpatine explained evenly.
"And yet you favor black and blue in everything you wear."
Palpatine's thin smile held.
"I'm flattered you notice."
Taria's expression turned devious.
"Many have taken notice of you, Senator."
Servants hurried over to take Valorum's and Taria's vetter-cloth cloaks.
"I hired them expressly for the evening," Palpatine said quietly. "I'm a solitary man at heart."
Taria spoke before Valorum could. "The title of the latest Hollownet piece about you, if I'm not mistaken. The senator who turned his back on a vast fortune to devote himself to politics, who worked his way up from Naboo's legislative body to the ambassadorship to the Galactic Senate." She smiled without showing her teeth.
"A heartwarming story."
"And every word of it true," Palpatine said. "From a certain point of view."
The three of them shared a laugh, and then Palpatine led them deeper into the press of guests, all of whom were well disposed toward Valorum. There was no one in the suite the Supreme Chancellor didn't know, and he greeted every one of them by name. The ability to make beings feel as if they mattered to him, personally as well as politically, was one of his few strengths. A protocol droid delivered drinks on a tray, and Valorum and Taria helped themselves to glasses. When Valorum's trophy excused herself to make conversation with the wife of Alderaanian Senator Bail Antilles, Palpatine steered Valorum into the suite's main room.
"How is it that you managed to enjoy the support of both the Core and Rim factions?"
Valorum asked in genuine interest.
"A consequence of Naboo's location more than anything else. Mine is something of a displaced world, located in the Rim but sharing the sensibilities of many of the Core worlds."
Valorum gestured to a figurine in a wall niche.
"Exquisite." "Quite. A gift from Senator Elan Lee."
"From Triffers?"
Palpatine reoriented the figurine slightly.
"A museum piece, actually."
Valorum continued along the wall, indicating a second piece.
"And this?" "A ceremonial grand wind drum, over 1,000 years old."
He glanced out of the corner of his eye at Valorum.
"A present from Basco Yizrim."
Valorum nodded.
"Senator Ainley Team's aide. I didn't realize you were on good terms with the Grand Protectorate."
Palpatine shrugged.
"For a time I wasn't, owing to a long-standing feud over Naboo's abstention in a senatorial vote of some significance at the time, but ancient history now."
Valorum lowered his voice to ask,
"Do you think you could bring Malastare over to my side?"
Palpatine swung to look at him.
"Regarding the embargo of Yinchor, possibly, but not on the matter of taxing the free trade zones. Both Ainley Team and Oxmo have become allies of the Trade Federation. An even more bewildering reversal, Valorum sighed. Friends become enemies, enemies, friends. I suspect I'm going to have to call in every political favor I'm owed to succeed at Yinjor. He compressed his lips and shook his head. I fear my legacy is on the line here, old friend. I've only 1 year left of my term, but I'm determined to see things through.
Palpatine countered a compassionate tone.
If it's any solace, I support the use of a paramilitary force, even at the risk of escalating the crisis, if only to silence those who have accused the Republic of being spineless.
Valorum clapped Palpatine on the shoulder. Your support is appreciated. He looked around the room, then asked even more quietly,
Whom can I count on, Palpatine?
Palpatine's eyes scanned the crowd, alighting briefly on two human males, an Ankh who wouldn't have fit in a room with lower ceilings, an Ithorian, and finally a Tarnap.
Antilles, Com Fordox, Horrocks Rider, Tendal Bendon, perhaps Motnot Rob?
Valorum eyed them in turn, then let his gaze settle on a Rodian.
Far?
Palpatine laughed to himself. Onaconda Far thought of politics the way his Rodian brethren thought of bounty hunting. Shoot first, ask questions later.
He's a militant, but I may be able to persuade him, as he enjoys close ties with House Naberi of Naboo.
Tychus? Valorum asked, gazing covertly at the Quarren senator, whose facial tentacles were manipulating snacks into his mouth.
Tychus will want something in return, but yes.
Valorum's pale blue eyes found Wookiee Senator Yarua. Palpatine nodded.
Kashyyyk will support you.
Valorum drained his drink glass and set it aside. And my opponents?
Aside from the obvious ones, the entire Ryloth group, Ornfrit Tah, Conestrel and Chomfrit Kaa, also Tun Baktura, Edsel Bargan, Ponudo. Do you want me to go on?
Valorum looked discouraged as they stepped out onto the balcony. A tone sounded, indicating that the noise cancellation feature had been activated. Valorum continued to the railing and stared off into the distance.
A rare dark night, he said after a moment.
Palpatine joined him at the railing.
Weather control is brewing a storm.
He turned slightly to adjust the noise cancellation system.
Listen. Peals of thunder over the works. And there, he added, pointing. Lightning.
How unnatural it seems here. If only we might be as easily cleansed as this vast sky and these monumental buildings. Palpatine glanced at him.
The Senate has obstructed you, but you've brought no dishonor to the office.
Valorum considered it.
I knew when my first term began that I would face opposition, that events had been spiraling out of control since the Stark conflict. But since then, I've sensed a darkness approaching from the outer reaches of the galaxy to shake Coruscant to its foundations. You would think, after 1,000 years of peace, that the Republic would be unshakable. But that isn't the case. I've always placed my faith in the Force, believing that if I acted in accordance with its guiding principles, the galaxy would act in kind.
Palpatine frowned in the dark.
The Republic has grown unwieldy. We are coerced and cajoled into deals that compromise our integrity. We are criticized as much for what we do as what we don't do. Most beings in the Corps couldn't point to Yinshore in a star map, and yet the crisis there becomes your problem.
Valorum nodded in a distracted way.
We can't stand by and do nothing. The Jedi Express is much in private, and yet even they are divided.
If Master Dooku becomes any more vocal in his criticisms of the Senate and the Order, the Council may have to restrict him to the Temple. He fell silent, then said,
Well, I certainly don't have to tell you. People tell me you've become his confidant.
Instead of responding to that comment, Palpatine said,
And Master Yoda...
Inscrutable as ever, Valorum said. But troubled, I think. Palpatine turned away from him slightly. The Jedi have faced down darkness in the past. True, but a study of history reveals that they have been defeated by it as well. Then the outcome is not in our grasp. Valorum raised his gaze to the night sky. Whose, then? Chapter 23. Under the Midnight Sun. Just arrived on the Hunter's Moon, Sidious studied Plagueis as the Sith Lord and his droid 114D viewed a holorecording of a black-robed Zabrak assassin making short work of combat automata in his home on Coruscant, some hovering, some advancing on two legs, others on treads, and all firing blasters. 20 years had added a slight stoop to the Moon's posture, and veins that stood out under his thinning white skin. He wore a dark green utility suit that hugged his delicate frame, a green cloak that fell from his bony shoulders to the fort's stone floor, and a headpiece that hewed to his large cranium. A triangular breath mask covered his ruined, prognathous lower jaw, his mouth, part of his long neck, and what remained of the craggy nose he'd had before the surprise attack in the Fobozi. A device of his own invention, the alloy mask featured two vertical slits and a pair of thin, stiff conduits that linked it to a transpirator affixed to his upper chest beneath an armored torso harness. He had learned to ingest and imbibe through feeding tubes and through his nose. Seen through the Force, he was a nuclear oval of mottled light, a rotating orb of terrifying energy. If the Maladian attack had weakened him physically, it had also helped to shape his etheric body into a vessel sufficiently strong to contain the full power of the dark side. Determined never again to be caught off guard, he had trained himself to go without sleep and had devoted 2 standard decades to day and night experimentation with midichlorian manipulation and attempts to wrest a few last secrets from the Force so that he, and presumably his human apprentice, might live forever. His inward turn had enabled him to master the equally powerful energies of order and disorder, creation and entropy, life and death.
"You have made him fearsome,"
Plagueis remarked without turning from the recording, as the athletic Zabrak cleaved a colicoid eradicator droid down the middle and whirled to cut 2 others in half. The yellow-eyed humanoid's hairless head bore a crown of small horns and geometrical patterns of black and red markings.
"Fearless as well," Sidious said.
"Still, they are only droids."
"He's even more formidable against living beings."
Plagueis looked over his shoulder, his eyes narrowed in question.
"You've fought him in a serious way?"
Reconstructed vocal cords and trachea imparted a metallic quality to his voice, as if he were speaking through an annunciator.
"I stranded him on Hypori for a month without food and with only a horde of assassin droids for company. Then I returned to goad and challenge him. All things considered, he fought well even after I deprived him of his lightsaber. He wanted to kill me, but was prepared to die at my hand."
Plagueis turned fully to face him.
"Rather than punish him for disobedience, you praised his resolve."
"He was already humbled. I chose to leave his honor intact. I proclamyed him my Myrmidon, the embodiment of the violent half of our partnership."
"Partnership?"
"His and mine, not ours."
"Regardless, you allowed him to believe that he is more skilled than he actually is."
"Did you not do the same for me?"
Plagueis' eyes reflected disappointment.
"Never, Sidious. I have always been truthful with you."
Sidious bowed his head in acknowledgement.
"I am not the teacher you are."
Plagueis spent a long moment observing the hollow recording. The Zabrak's fist and legs were as lethal as his lightsaber, and his speed was astounding.
"Who applied the markings?"
"The mother did. in keeping with rituals enacted shortly after birth. An initiation during which a Dathomirian Zablok infant is submerged in an oily bath, energized with ichor conjured by the Night Sister's use of magics.
A peculiar decision, given her hope to send the child into hiding.
The Night Sisters rarely leave Dathomir, but Night Brothers are sometimes sold into servitude. I believe the mother wished him to be aware of his heritage wherever he ended up.
On seeing the Zabrak's lightsaber produce two blades, Plagueis drew in his breath.
A saber staff? The weapon of Exar Kun? Did he construct that?
The prototype was two lightsabers he had welded pommel to pommel in imitation of the Iridonian Jaboka. I furnished the knowledge that allowed him to improve on the original design and construct the one he is using. Plagueis watched as droid after droid was impaled on the opposing crimson blades.
It strikes me as unnecessary, but I won't deny his mastery of the Jarkai technique.
Again he turned to Sidious.
Neeman and Teres Kasi will never substitute for Dune Mok, but I appreciate that you have trained him to be a fighting machine rather than a true apprentice.
Thank you, Master.
Plagueis' eyes wrinkled. In suspicion? In amusement?
I agree with you that he should bear witness to the Yinchori attack on the Jedi Temple.
I will tell him. He already thinks of the Jedi as abominations. The sight of their sanctuary being violated will quicken his blood.
Even so, hold him back. Let his anger and hatred fester.
Sidious bowed his head. Plagueis deactivated the holoprojector.
The gift you requested for him is nearly complete.
Wraith Senar has agreed to have the vessel delivered to Sojourn, and I will arrange to have it brought to the Limerge building.
He made a beckoning motion with his fingers.
Come, Darth Sidious. There is much to discuss.
The ancient fort had never felt more forlorn. A company of sun guards still resided on Sojourn, escorting visitors to the surface and keeping the ground-based turbolasers in good working order. Authentication codes were still required for ships entering Sojourn space, but the moon's coordinates were no longer the secret they had once been. For the most part, Plagueis had lived like a hermit among his droids, seldom venturing off-world, though continuing to use his vast wealth and influence to support those organizations that furthered the Sith cause and crushed the plans of those he opposed. For the first year following the attack, rumors swirled that Higo Damask was dead, but word gradually began to circulate that he was merely living in seclusion on Sojourn. 4 years later, the annual gatherings had resumed, but only for 5 years. And now there hadn't been a gathering in more than a decade. Fewer and fewer beings had attended the events in any case, many having distanced themselves from Damask in the wake of the murders on Coruscant. During the long period between the Grand's sneak attack and the first gathering of the new era, Sidious had spoken with Plagueis only by holo. Left to progress on his own, he had trained the Zabrak in secret on Mustafar, Tosti, and Orsus, visited several Sith worlds, and spent considerable time studying the Sith texts and holocrons that remained under guard on Abora. From the Sun Guards, Sidious heard that Damask had locked himself away in the fort and was scarcely seen. On the few occasions Damask had summoned them, they had found the living quarters in shambles, some of the experimental subjects dead in their cages or cells, and many of the droids malfunctioning. Creatures from the surrounding Greel forests had invaded and taken up residence in the place, making nests in the turrets and devouring anything edible. While Damask, unwashed, emaciated, erratic in his behavior, had seemed capable of speech, it was 114D who had communicated Damask's orders and requests to the guards. At one point, the guards had been ordered to install more than 200 holoprojectors in what had been the fort's armory, so that Damask could both monitor current events and immerse himself in historical recordings, some of which dated back hundreds of years. Sidious knew that his own powers had increased tenfold over the decades, but he couldn't be certain he had learned all of Plagueis' secrets, his sorcerer's ways, as the Sun Guards referred to them, including the ability to prevent beings from dying. He sometimes wondered, was he a level behind? Two levels behind? Such questions were precisely what had driven generations of Sith apprentices ultimately to challenge their masters. The uncertainty about who was the more powerful, the need to test themselves, to face the definitive trial, the temptation to take the mantle by force, to put one's own spin on the power of the dark side, as Darth Gravid had attempted, only to set the Sith back countless years. And so it had been largely left to Sidious to bring the same fervor to the manipulation of events in the mundane world that Plagueis brought to the manipulation of midichlorians. Instead of challenging each other, they had both dedicated themselves to executing the grand plan. Political mastery and mastery of the Force. Someday soon, the Sith would wield both, with Sidious the face of the former, and Plagueis behind the scenes advising him about the latter. Like Plagueis, Sidious had moved judiciously, for unintended repercussions in the real world could be as damaging to the Sith imperative as blowback from the Force. The fact that the Force had not struck back argued that their partnership was something unique and in accordance with the will of the Force. Plagueis' self-imposed isolation had taken a toll on some of the plans he and Sidious had engineered for the Trade Federation and other groups. But Plagueis had made what amounted to a full recovery from his injuries, and the dark side was no longer simply on the ascendant, but risen and climbing toward the zenith. The Yanchori crisis was the first time that Plagueis had sanctioned Sidious's direct involvement in galactic events. Until then, events manipulated by the Sith had been accomplished through the use of intermediaries. But when Sidious enlisted the aid of the Deveronian smuggler to instigate the Yanchori, he had not only made contact by holoprojector, without revealing his Sith identity, of course, but also put him in touch with Pestage and Doriana, who had assisted in the dumping of the bodies of the dead Jedi on Valorum's threshold, and had facilitated the insertion of the Yanchori warriors tasked with infiltrating the Jedi Temple. Initially, the plan had been devised as a test, to see whether the Force-suggestion-resistant reptilian sentience could be fashioned into an anti-Jedi army. But in the same way that repeated attempts at replication by cloning had failed, all efforts to fashion them into an obedient army had proved futile. Custom-made for aggression they were, but also unpredictable and unruly. As a result, a redesigned stratagem had been put into motion to test Valorum's ability to manage a crisis and the Senate's resolve to end one. But neither Plagueis nor Sidious had expected the Supreme Chancellor to involve the Jedi, and now the modified plan was at risk as well.
"It's well and good that Jedi have died," Plagueis was saying as he, Sidious, and 114D entered his cluttered study. "But we must guard against revealing our hand too soon. Was it wise to have the corpses shipped to Coruscant?"
"They had the intended effect on Valorum."
"Nevertheless, we may have misjudged him."
"He's more concerned about his legacy than he is about the Republic. But he may yet win a majority of the Senate over to his side, even at the cost of all his political cachet."
"We need to engineer a crisis from which he can't recover."
"I have set just such events in motion."
Plagueis nodded in satisfaction.
"Then perhaps there is a beneficial side to this. If the Senate approves an embargo, he will be indebted to you."
Sidious smiled tightly.
"A blockade enacted for a blockade broken."
"To that end, we must begin to move Viceroy Newt Gunray and King Varuna into position. The Nymoidian was partnered with Valorum during the Stark conflict. This time, we will pit them against each other."
"I knew Gunray slightly when he served as a senator. He is acquisitive and ambitious, but oddly immune to intimidation. We will need to win him over."
"And so we shall, with procurements that will earn him a position among the 7 who make up the Trade Federation Directorate."
"How should we approach him?"
The gift you requisitioned for the Zabrok prompted an idea. Gunray is fond of pilots, which the Nymordians associate with wealth. The avians are abundant on Nymordia, but Sojourn's forests support a rare red-spotted white one, which the Kaminoans supplied. He will never identify it as a clone.
A gift from Higo Damask or Senator Palpatine? Plagueis looked him up and down.
From Darth Sidious, I think.
Sidious stared at him in doubt. By name?
Not merely by name, but by title as well. It is time we make our presence known to a select few.
Will the Sith title have any meaning for him?
When we make his dreams come true.
Plagueis began to pace the cool floor.
No Sith have ever been in the position in which we now find ourselves, Darth Sidious. In step with the reemergence of the dark side. Fortified by the signs and omens. Certain that revenge and victory are near at hand. If the Jedi would abide by their philosophy of acting in accordance with the Force, of doing what is right, they would roll over for the dark. But they resist. Yoda and the rest of the council members will double their meditation sessions in an effort to peer into the future. Only to discover it clouded and unknowable. Only to discover that complacency has opened the door to catastrophe. If indeed they have been acting in accordance with the Force, how could we be succeeding in tipping the balance? How could the dark side be gaining ground? In fact, the Jedi have fallen away from their self-assigned duty, their noble path. Could they have prevented it? Perhaps by having remained in control of the Republic, by electing and re-electing Jedi Supreme Chancellors, or perhaps by absenting themselves completely from the affairs of the Republic and attending to their arcane rituals in the belief that right thinking by them would keep the Republic strong and on course. The galaxy tipped into the light, instead of having allowed themselves to become marshals and enforcers.
He cast a questioning look at Sidious.
Do you see the grand error of their ways? They execute the Republic's business as if it were the business of the Force. But has a political body ever succeeded in being the arbiter of what is right and just? How easy it is for them to bask in self-assurance in their castle on Coruscant. But in so doing, they have rendered themselves ill-equipped for the world we have spent a millennium bringing into being.
He cleared his throat.
We're going to back them into a contradiction, Darth Sidious. We're going to force them to confront the moral quandary of their position and reveal their flaws by requiring them to oversee the conflicts that plague their vaunted republic. Only Dooku and a handful of others have grasped the truth. All those years ago, when I first met him on Serenno, I thought, what a blow it would be to the Order if he could be enticed to leave and embrace the dark side. What a panic it might incite. For if one could leave, then 10 or 20 or 30 could follow, and the hollowness at the center of the Order would be plain for all to see.
The Mune's eyes narrowed.
One can't be content to abide by the rules of the Jedi Order or the Force. Only by making the Force serve us have we prevailed. 8 years ago, we shifted the galaxy, Darth Sidious, and that shift is now irreversible.
Approaching, he rested his bony hands on Sidious's shoulders.
On my first visit to your homeworld, I recognized it as a nexus in the Force, and I remember thinking how appropriate it was that the dark side should be hiding on such a beautiful planet.
He paused, straightened, then asked with sudden gravity,
Is Varuna ready, Sidious? I'm concerned that he might be as uncontrollable as the Yinchore and that a more malleable leader would better serve our interests.
Sidious considered the question. It may not be necessary to remove him, Master. Like Gunray, he favors wealth over honor. Plagueis nodded his head slowly.
Then nudge him, Darth Sidious, and let us see which way he leans before we decide his fate.
Chapter 24, Sith Ahri. Their targets were only asteroids, but the chromium-nosed yellow starfighters attacked the micro-cratered rocks as if they posed a threat to Naboo itself. Products of the Feed Space Vessel Engineering Corporation and Nubian Design, and King Varuna's pet project since his coronation, the sleek, short-winged craft exemplified the Naboo's infatuation with classic design and flagrant extravagance. The starfighter's engines were said to have set a new standard for emissions control, but for a world that prided itself on environmental awareness, the N1s seemed entirely out of character and out of place.
"We're expected to have two additional squadrons ready for flight by the start of the year,"
Varuna told Palpatine as they stood at a dorsal viewport in the King's even more grandiose, mirror-finish royal starship.
"All will feature twin laser cannons, proton torpedo launchers and deflector shields, along with R2 astromech droids."
"A dream come true," Palpatine said.
"Both for you and for the Nubian Design Collective."
Varuna arched a bushy gray and white eyebrow.
"Our deal with Nubian Design was mutually beneficial."
"Of course it was," Palpatine said,
wondering how much Varuna and his cronies had pocketed on a contract most Naboo had opposed. Palpatine had arrived with Pestige and had met Downside with Janus Grigiatus before rendezvousing with Varuna and some of the members of his advisory council at Feed Hangar, including Prime Counselor Kun Largo and the King's sharp-featured female security chief, Maris Magneta. Conspicuously absent was Theed's teenage governor, Padme Nabere, whose appointment had been Varuna's compromise to an electorate that had been growing more oppositional with each passing year. Varuna, however, looked none the worse for wear. With his flaring eyebrows, long silver hair, and fussily pointed beard, he still cut a fine swashbuckling figure. Largo and Magneta were considerably younger and more rough-cut, and had made their distaste for Palpatine and his party felt the moment they had boarded the gleaming starship. Outside the viewport, strafing runs by Bravo Squadron were reducing asteroids to gravel and space dust.
"That's Captain Rick Ollier in Bravo One," Varuna said, battle-hardened at Chamal Minor.
Pestige failed to restrain a short laugh.
"Against that pirate group whose ships collided with one another?"
Varuna stared at Palpatine.
"Your aide seems to have forgotten his place, Senator."
Palpatine flashed Pestige a look that said nothing and turned back to Varuna.
"My apologies, Your Majesty."
If Varuna was unconvinced, he kept it to himself and fixed his gaze on the distant starfighter exercise.
"I plan to end our partnership with the Trade Federation," he said after a long moment of silence and without looking at Palpatine.
Palpatine moved slightly to place himself in Varuna's peripheral view, his eyes wide in genuine surprise.
"Is that the purpose of this demonstration?"
The King turned to him.
"If I had wanted it to be a show of force, I would have waited until the next scheduled plasma collection. However, since you seem to be asking, both Theed Engineering and Nubian Design assure me that the Federation's Luka Hulk freighters would be easy prey for our N1s."
Palpatine cut his eyes to Pestige and Grigiatus and shook his head in dismay.
"Then it's good you thought to invite me aboard, Your Majesty, because I bring news that may persuade you to rethink your position."
"What news?" Magneta demanded. Palpatine ignored her by continuing to speak to Varuna.
"This matter has yet to reach the Rotunda,
but there is every indication that the Republic is eventually going to grant the Trade Federation permission to arm its ships.
Varuna's jaw dropped and he blinked.
With what?
Palpatine pretended to become flustered.
I don't know precisely. Turbo lasers, certainly, as well as droid starfighters. Whatever combat automata are being produced by Bactoid, Heor Chal, and the Hive species.
He gestured out the viewport.
Weapons that will prove to be a deadly match for those starfighters.
Varuna was still trying to make sense of it.
Why is the Republic doing this? Because of what happened at Yenchor. Because of persistent attacks by pirates and would-be insurrectionists. And because the Republic refuses to reverse its position on creating a military.
Varuna stormed away from the viewport, then stopped and whirled on Palpatine.
I don't believe it. Valorum was successful at Yenchor. He would never bow to pressure from the Trade Federation. He isn't bowing to pressure. His strategy is to enter into a deal with the Federation. Defensive weaponry in exchange for taxation of the free trade zones.
Varuna was speechless.
This is why I urge your majesty to keep Naboo on the proper side of this.
Do tell us, Senator, Lago interrupted, what it means to be on the proper side.
Palpatine glanced from Lago to Varuna.
When the matter reaches the Rotunda, the Naboo must vote in protest of taxation of the free trade zones.
Varuna swallowed and found his voice.
In support of the Trade Federation? With my re-election approaching? You must be mad, Palpatine. Naboo has been under the yoke of the Federation for more than 30 years. The people would never forgive me.
Your base remains strong, Palpatine said. The people will gradually come to understand that you made the correct decision.
Varuna smoldered.
I don't like being put in this position, Palpatine.
Palpatine adopted a pensive pose, then looked at the king.
There may yet be a way. I'm certain that Higo Damask would be willing to broker a renegotiated deal with the Nymordian bloc of the Trade Federation.
I don't need Damask to broker anything, Varuna snapped. The Mune's time has come and gone. He's an anachronism. His enemies did us all a favor by forcing him into early retirement.
Palpatine's eyes narrowed imperceptibly. And so with a nudge, he reveals himself.
If I recall correctly, Damask's enemies paid dearly.
He fell silent for a moment, repositioning himself in front of the viewport, so that Varuna would have the strafing starfighters in direct view while he listened.
Granted, Sojourn isn't the impregnable fortress it once was, but Damask's reach is as long as it ever was, and his ties to the banking clan have never been stronger.
In case you haven't noticed, Senator, Magneta interjected, Naboo's reach is now long as well.
Palpatine glanced over his shoulder at the starfighters, then fixed his eyes on Varuna.
Your Majesty, Damask will not take kindly to being cut out of our dealings with the Trade Federation. He can make trouble.
Varuna's gaze wandered back to him.
Let him try. Naboo isn't the only world he has exploited. We would not want for allies. I'm more concerned about how the Senate would react to our voting against taxation of the trade zones.
Palpatine forced a breath.
It's a hopeless situation. The Rim faction worlds rely on the Trade Federation for goods, so they will likely vote in the negative. The core worlds, on the other hand, will vote in favor of taxation, if only to bring revenue to the Republic and avoid having to support the outlying systems. Occupying the middle ground, the Trade Federation stands to win no matter what, in that it will finally be allowed to defend itself and will force its clients to shoulder the increased costs that will result from taxation.
What does all this mean for Valorum?
Lago said.
I fear that he may not complete his term of office.
Who will succeed him? Varuna asked.
That's difficult to say, Your Majesty. Ainley Teem, I think, though Bail Antilles enjoy some support.
Varuna thought about it.
What are the implications for Naboo
should the Gran win over the Alderanian.
Then, of course, you would have a friend in the Chancellorship.
Varuna tugged at his beard.
I'll take your recommendations into account. But be forewarned, Palpatine. I will brook no deception. From you.
He fixed Pestage and Gregatus with a gimlet stare.
Or any of your cabal. Remember, I know where the bodies are buried.
Time is short. Vines and creepers had clawed their way up the walls and towers of the old fort, and lianas linked the crenellated parapets to the leafy crowns of nearby trees. Insects scurried underfoot, foraging for food, or laden with bits of vegetation or scraps of splintered wood. The previous night's storms had left puddles ankle-deep on the walkway, and runoff cascaded through firing holes. The forest Plagueis had planted and stocked with rare and exotic game seemed determined to rid Sojourn of the fortress that had been erected in its midst. From the tallest of the towers, he gazed over the treetops at the rim of the moon's parent world and the distant star they shared. Sojourn was running fast, and the last light was fading. The air was balmy and riotous with the drone and stridulation of insects, the territorial cries of avians, the mournful waking howls of creatures of the night. Clouds of bats spilled from caves in the escarpment, devouring bloodsuckers borne by the strong rains. A breeze rose out of nowhere. Time is short. Still in safekeeping on Abora were texts and holocrons that recounted the deeds and abilities of Sith masters who, so it was said and written, had been able to summon wind or rain or fracture the skies with conjured lightning. In their own words or those of their disciples, a few Dark Lords claimed to have had the ability to fly, become invisible, or transport themselves through space and time. But Plagueis had never succeeded in duplicating any of those phenomena. From the start, Tenebris had told him that he lacked the talent for Sith sorcery, even though the inability hadn't owed to a deficiency of midichlorians.
"It's an innate gift," the Bith would say when pressed,
and one that he had lacked as well. Sorcery paled in comparison with Bith science regardless, but Plagueis now understood that Tenebris had been wrong about sorcery, as he had been wrong about so many things. Yes, the gift was strongest in those who, with scant effort, could allow themselves to be subsumed by the currents of the Force and become conduits for the powers of the dark side. But there was an alternative path to those abilities, and it led from a place where the circle closed on itself and sheer will substituted for selflessness. Plagueis understood, too, that there were no powers beyond his reach, none he couldn't master through an effort of will. If a Sith of equal power had preceded him, then that one had taken his or her secrets to the grave, or had locked them away in holocrons that had been destroyed or had yet to surface. The question of whether he and Sidious had discovered something new or rediscovered something ancient was beside the point. All that mattered was that almost a decade earlier, they had succeeded in willing the Force to shift and tip irrevocably to the dark side. Not a mere paradigm shift, but a tangible alteration that could be felt by anyone strong in the Force, and whether or not trained in the Sith or Jedi arts. The shift had been the outcome of months of intense meditation, during which Plagueis and Sidious had sought to challenge the Force for sovereignty and suffuse the galaxy with the power of the dark side. Brazen and shameless, at their own mortal peril, they had waged etheric war, anticipating that their own midichlorians, the Force's proxy army, might marshal to boil their blood or stop the beating of their hearts. Risen out of themselves, discorporate, and as a single entity, they had brought the power of their will to bear, asserting their sovereignty over the Force. No counterforce had risen against them. In what amounted to a state of rapture, they knew that the Force had yielded, as if some deity had been tipped from its throne. On the fulcrum they had fashioned, the light side had dipped, and the dark side
had ascended. On the same day, they had allowed Venomous to die. Then, by manipulating the Bith's midichlorians, which should have been inert and unresponsive, Plagueis had resurrected him. The enormity of the event had stunned Sidious into silence and overwhelmed and addled 114D's processors. But Plagueis had carried on without assistance, again and again allowing Venomous to die and be returned to life, until the Bith's organs had given out and Plagueis had finally granted him everlasting death. But having gained the power to keep another alive hadn't been enough for him. And so after Sidious had returned to Coruscant, he had devoted himself to internalizing that ability by manipulating the midichlorians that animated him. For several months, he made no progress, but ultimately he began to perceive a measured change. The scars that had grown over his wounds had abruptly begun to soften and fade, and he had begun to breathe more freely than he had in 20 years. He began to sense that not only were his damaged tissues healing, but his entire body was rejuvenating itself. Beneath the transpirator, areas of his skin were smooth and youthful, and he knew that eventually he would cease to age altogether. Drunk on newfound power, then, he had attempted an even more unthinkable act, to bring into being a creation of his own. Not merely the impregnation of some hapless, mindless creature, but the birth of a forceful being. The ability to dominate death had been a step in the right direction, but it wasn't equivalent to pure creation. And so he had stretched out, indeed as if invisible, transubstantiated, to inform every being of his existence and impact all of them. Munoid or insectoid, secure or dispossessed, free or enslaved, a warrior waving a banner in triumph on a battlefield, a ghost infiltrating a dream. But ultimately, to no end. The force grew silent, as if in flight from him, and many of the animals in his laboratory succumbed to horrifying diseases. Regardless, 8 long years later, Plagueis remained convinced that he was on the verge of absolute success. The evidence was in his own increased midichlorian count, and in the power he sensed in Sidious when he had finally returned to Sojourn. The dark side of the Force was theirs to command, and in partnership, they would someday be able to keep each other alive, and to rule the galaxy for as long as they saw fit. But he had yet to inform Sidious of this. It was more important that Sidious remain as focused on manipulating events in the profane world as Plagueis was intent on dominating the realm of the Force, of which the mundane was only a gross and distorted reflection. To be sure, the light had been extinguished, but for how long and at what cost? He recalled a stellar eclipse he had witnessed on a long-forgotten world, whose single moon was of perfect size and distance to blot out the light of the system's primary. The result hadn't been total darkness, but illumination of a different sort, singular and diffuse, that had confused the birds and had permitted the stars to be seen in what would have been broad daylight. Even totally blocked, the primary had shone from behind the satellite's disk, and when the moon moved on, there had been a moment of light almost too intense to bear. Gazing into Sojourn's darkening sky, he wondered what calamity the Force was planning in retreat to visit upon him or Sidious or both of them for willfully tipping the balance. Was retribution merely waiting in the wings, as it had been on Coruscant 20 years earlier? It was a dangerous time, more dangerous than his earliest years as an apprentice, when the dark side might have consumed him at any moment. For now at least, his full convalescence was near complete. Sidious was continuing to become more powerful as a Sith and as a politician, his most intricate schemes meeting with little or no resistance. And the Jedi Order was foundering. Time would tell. and time was short.